Good morning and welcome to Politics Up Close on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson. Many Utah Republicans were in Tampa, Florida this week to cast their votes for Mitt Romney at the Republican National Convention and hear him accept the party's nomination last night, but GOP congressional candidate Chris Stewart stayed back here in Utah, making his case for the 2nd Congressional District, which stretches from southern Utah all the way up to Salt Lake City and Davis County. The author and former Air Force pilot beat a multitude of other Republicans to win his party's nomination for the seat at the often contentious GOP state convention earlier this year. He joins me now to discuss his platform, experience, and his authorship of books like 7 Miracles That Saved America. And Chris, thanks for joining us on the show.
Good morning, Jeff. Thank you.
Listeners, join us on the air with congressional candidate Chris Stewart this morning. Our phone number is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Well, to start off, Chris, why did you decide to hang back here in Utah this week rather than go to the convention, which, you know, for many people in Utah is a very historic one with Mitt Romney as the nominee?
It is. It is. It's a big deal for the state, isn't it? I mean, we have kind of adopted Mitt as one of our own. Mm-hmm. We identify with so many of the values that that he's espousing. And you know, I think it's a proud moment for the state of Utah. And frankly, it's a proud moment for Republicans and for the nation as well. But to your question, why did we decide to stay back? You know, we could have gone down and enjoyed the party and you know, spent some time with friends down there. But we just felt like we could do more for our campaign and more for the people in our district if we stayed here, kept working. And it's been a good week for us. We've had a number of media opportunities. We've had some really good meetings. We had a party down at GOP headquarters last night where we had, you know, hundreds of people there. Mm-hmm. And it was a fun week. It's been a good week for us, and I think we've made a good decision, and we're glad to be back here with the people in our district.
So, Chris, this is a very, very large district to campaign in.
Boy, is it ever.
Tell me about some of the campaigning you've been doing in the rural parts of the state and others with such a huge swath of territory to cover.
You know, I don't know how many thousands of miles I put on my car in the last 8 months, but it is a boatload. This district is the jewel of the state. It really is. It's where we're sitting now. It's the downtown Salt Lake City area. It's the university. It's the LDS church properties and then, you know, part of Davis County. And as you said, it swings all the way down south to, you know, Zions, where I love to go rock climbing, some of the great parks, and it's just... You know, I would be so proud to represent this district. But I like what the legislators did. And I know there was some controversy about it, and some people mm-hmm. may disagree. But I think their intention was to have some urban and some rural interest. And they did that. And you know, when we talk to folks here in Davis County or in Salt Lake County and the issues that they're interested in, they're very different than mm-hmm. when we hear and go down south and talk to people in Kane County or Garfield County or Washington County. And I think it's good for us to be in a position where your representatives, congressmen or congresswomen, are representing, you know, urban and rural and a wide range of backgrounds and interests to people.
And isn't that a big challenge, though, Chris, because here in Salt Lake City in particular, and this district does include just about all of Salt Lake City, the interests are going to be, you know, frankly, quite more Democratic-leaning, quite more progressive, liberal-leaning. Yeah. How can you be a representative for such a diverse group of people? You come from, obviously, a more conservative background. What would you say, then, to the parts of the district that are more liberal and Democratic?
Well, you know, I think that we've had pretty good success in reaching out to a lot of different folks. You know, my background is something that a lot of people would identify with. I come from a family of 10 kids, milk and cows. We didn't grow up with a lot of money. We didn't have any Mercedes sitting in our driveway when I was growing up. My wife is a teacher. My father was an educator. I have a sister and a brother that were career educators. You know, I come from anything but one of the 1%, if you will. And I think that's given me some perspective of some of the important issues for some of the folks who live in what you've described here as maybe the more Democratic-leaning parts of the district. And again, kind of come what I was saying before, just like we should represent an urban and a rural constituency, mm-hmm. we should also, to the best extent that we can, represent those from a different perspective on our political leanings. And one of the things, and I'm not a Tea Party candidate, I've never claimed to be a Tea Party candidate, we've never taken a position on a lot of the very, you know, Tea Party oriented issues, and we want to work with some of the folks that that we recognize they have a perspective, that they have concerns, and we'll do everything we can to work with them on those things.
This is Politics Up Close. My guest is Chris Stewart. He is the Republican nominee for Utah's 2nd Congressional District in this year's election. 801-355-TALK is our phone number this morning, 801-355-8255. You can also send your comments and questions on Twitter to us at KCPW. Chris, talk about your own history here in Utah, about how long you've lived here and your history with the 2nd District in particular.
Well, you know, like we were talking, Jeff, as we're talking about your home of Virginia and how mm-hmm. much we love it there, a beautiful state. But when I got out of the Air Force after serving for 14 years, we could have lived anywhere. I was writing books at the time, and, you know, you could, as I said, live anywhere while you're doing that. And we wanted to come to Utah. I mean, this is my home. I actually grew up in Cache Valley. Spent most of my adult life outside of the state as I was serving in the military. But there's just no other place like Utah. And I mean, as I said before, I love to rock climb. We were talking about going camping this weekend. And the natural beauty and some of those things are an important part of that, but it's more than that. The people here, the diversity in geography, I love mm-hmm. the weather. You know, there's just no place like Utah. And I guess I'm Dorothy. There's no place like home, right? And that's, you know, that's why we're so proud to be in a position where maybe we could represent some of the people in this state. But I gained an appreciation when we were in the military. We had the opportunity to live all over this country. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times we moved. And we enjoyed everywhere that we lived. But again, there's just something that's really quite special about this place here.
Chris, getting to your campaign platform a bit, one of the things you've been saying in your campaign materials is that the nation is at a tipping point, and this is, yeah. I know, a term you've used in some of your previous book titles as well. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. You know, thanks for that question, because I really think it's an important question. And frankly, that's the main reason, and that may be the only reason I got into this race. And I'm not a traditional politician. I haven't been positioning myself for the last, you know, number of years to run for office. I can look in the eye and tell you it has never been my life's ambition to be a congressman. And if you look at the things I've done, that's pretty clear. They were not a traditional, you know, a path that would lead you to running for office. But the irony is at the same time, those things prepared me to be a congressman. My background in the military is really important. Less than 20% of Congress has any military experience. My background as a business owner and my degree in economics is really important. Less than 8% of Congress has any small business experience. Those people need to hear my voice. They need to hear the voice of those who come from a different background other than a lawyer or politics. But you talk about this tipping point, and I, as you said, I've used that in some of my writing. I just believe, and it's easy to say, you know, this is most important election of our lifetime. I've said that a number of times in my life. I've said that to my kids. But this is not only the most important election of our lifetime. I would argue it's the most important election in generations. We will define who we are as a people at this time. And I don't mean just on the November election. I think it extends a little bit beyond that. But it literally is, in my mind, a tipping point. We will define who we are. We'll decide if we believe in the idea of American exceptionalism still. Do we believe in the idea of the American dream? Do we want to hand our children opportunities like our parents handed us? And I just think this moment is that important.
Do you view, I assume that part of what you're talking about is the growth of government in previous years, in the past 4 years. But do you view that as something that goes far beyond the past 4 years to the Bush administration?
Oh, absolutely.
As well?
Absolutely. And I've said that from the very beginning. Look, I am a conservative Republican. That's who I am. I'm proud of that. But, you know, I recognize that the Republicans in the early part of the century had an opportunity to do some good things, and I think they wasted that opportunity. I think they bought into some of the ideas that bigger government is better, and I don't. I think smaller government is better. I think they wasted opportunities with financial or fiscal discipline. There's no question about that. And, you know, there's enough blame to go around here. It's not just I don't think we can look at the current administration and say they're to blame for all of our problems. They're certainly not. These go back, you know, many more years than the last 4 years.
This is Politics Up Close on KCPW. My guest is Chris Stewart, the Republican nominee for Utah's 2nd Congressional District. And Chris, we'll go into some of your parts of your platform in a little bit more detail a bit later. But first, the big first hurdle that you had to overcome in this race was obviously winning the Republican nomination. And with Utah being such a GOP-leaning state, there were upwards of 10 or more candidates you beat at the state convention. Tell me about that experience.
You know, it was an interesting experience. When you get into this race, and the demographics of the 2nd Congressional District are such that Jim Matheson, who I hear a lot of good things about, and I respect him, and I think we should respect him, but he is the most well-known, most well-funded Democrat in the state, and he mm-hmm. looked at the 2nd Congressional District early on and said, I'm not going to run there, even though he lives here. He says, I'm going to run in the 4th.
Right.
It's a very conservative district. It's a very Republican-friendly district. So, you know, we didn't view this as once we win the nomination, the race is over. It's certainly not. As we are talking, I'm working 8-hour weeks. We're working really hard to win in November. We realize we have a challenge there. But one of the challenges, as you said, was winning out of the 11 Republican candidates who are running. And, you know, it's a lot more fun now to go out and be talking with our opponent about ideas and about issues rather than trying to contrast yourself with other Republicans for our many issues you agree. And then in that case, you have to, you know, go to your background and say, I'd be a better candidate because of this or because of this. That's okay. And I think, you know, it was appropriate, obviously, at the time. But it's a lot more interesting and engaging for people when we can now focus on the ideas. What are the different ideas and principles that we can talk about between the Democrat and the Republican candidates rather than talking about differences among Republicans?
Chris, as you know, the second race after the convention sparked an investigation by the party that formally cleared campaigns of wrongdoing, but at the same time, former Utah House Speaker David Clark and some of the others who were involved or mentioned in that investigation have filed a complaint against you with the Federal Elections Commission, basically alleging that you conspired with another candidate to make it look like there was some kind of smear campaign going on against you to sort of generate sympathy amongst the delegates. What is your response to that?
Well, you know, our response is we had a very aggressive response to the FEC, and I can promise you that they're not – I doubt they're even going to investigate it. This complaint against us reads like a fifth-grade Dick Tracy novel. It really does. I mean, here's the deal. We were winning leading up to the convention. We knew that. We had multitude polls. BYU Center for Democracy and Politics has done an extensive survey and confirms everything that we believed. These other candidates knew that we were winning, and they did what candidates do when they become desperate, and they attacked us. And the irony is that after attacking us and then being caught attacking us and working against us, they blamed us for the attacks on my campaign. I mean, people hear that and they go, it makes no sense at all. And, you know, we understand that sometimes people in the heat of the campaign, you know, do things or say things that, you know, maybe don't make a lot of sense in hindsight, and I think that's kind of what happened here. And, you know, most people don't talk about it. They're really not that interested in it because I think most people look at it and go, that seems kind of silly. It seems kind of absurd, and they see it's just as politics that they've seen in the past.
Well, Chris, some of them have brought in, you know, your brother into this conversation, Tim Stewart, who I understand has admitted being involved in a mailer that was involved at the 2010 convention against Senator Mike Lee's campaign. How do you respond to that, and was he involved in helping your campaign out in any way?
No. He's out in D.C. He wasn't involved with the campaign at all, not in any manner or fashion. And the other thing is, I would say Tim's a good man. He's an LDS bishop out in Virginia. He's in the LDS stake presidency out there. People have tried to paint him to be, much more of a deal than it was. But anyway, you know, Tim wasn't involved, and he's a good person, and I don't know why they brought that up, other than I think they were hoping to maybe, smear by association. But again, most folks just aren't that interested in it.
This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. My guest is Chris Stewart. He's the Republican nominee for Utah's 2nd Congressional District. Join us on the air at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. We're going to take a short break and be back with more Politics Up Close on KCBW. Welcome back to Politics Up Close on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson, and I'm speaking this hour with Chris Stewart. He's the Republican nominee for Utah's 2nd Congressional District, stretching from Davis County down to St. George. Join us on the air at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Send your tweets to us here at KCPW. Chris, let's talk a little bit about your experience as an author. When did you first get heavily involved in writing?
Well, it's been a while now. You know, I had an experience in college where I took a creative writing course and did very, very poorly. And that was my first experience with creative writing, and it wasn't a great one. I've never viewed myself, you know, I'm not one of these folks who you know, thought I'm going to write the great American novel one day. But while I was flying a B-1 pilot in the military, I had this idea once. I thought, that would make a great book. And I don't know, I just sat down one night and started typing, and even then I didn't think I'm going to write a book. It was really months later that I realized I think I'm writing a book. And we ended up getting an agent, and she was actually a very good agent. She worked with John Grisham and Tom Clancy and a lot of really the very top authors. But it was 4.5 years from the time I said, gosh, I think I'm writing a book, till I walked into a Barnes & Noble and saw a pile of my books there. It was a pretty cool moment, but it was not easy. I'll tell you, it didn't. And, of course, I was flying at the time, so I was working long hours in the military, not writing 10 hours a day kind of a thing. But I, one thing led to another, and I guess it's been probably 15 years, and I think 15 books now. New York Times bestselling author. I've had some success, and you know, I love writing. It's kind of who I am.
One of your more famous books is called Seven Miracles That Saved America. What's kind of the premise of this book and some of the miracles that you're referring to?
Yeah, you know, and that word miracle is kind of a key word for some people, and they go, well, you know, what do you mean by miracle, and do you really mean miracles? And you know, I was talking with a friend of mine. He was actually sick with cancer at the time, and we spent some time together. And he told me this story about Abraham Lincoln during the Battle of Gettysburg. And I thought, wow, how come I've never heard that? You know, I'm not a historian, but I thought I'm reasonably well-read, and I've never heard that story. And I asked Sam Matt, and he was an educator, and he walked over to his bookshelf and pulled out a high school history book from the 1930s. And he opened up and he said, look, we used to teach these things, and we don't teach them anymore. And that was kind of the genesis for the idea, was there are things in our history that are important, they're significant, and we don't talk about them much. And I think we lose something of the context of our culture and our heritage and our history when we don't. And so we wanted to put these ideas of seven extraordinary events in American history which changed the future of our nation. And the follow-up book to that, although we didn't intend it as a follow-up, it just kind of happened, was looking at world history in the same way, seven tipping points in world history. And there are times when everything changes. There really are times in U.S. history and in world history where an event will happen and everything changes after that. And it was just, they're just such fascinating stories, and it's so fun to be involved with that.
What's one of the seven miracles specifically about America you discuss?
In the world history book, do you mean,
the American one, the first one.
You know, I guess my favorite probably would be this story of Gettysburg. And, you know, everyone looks at Gettysburg, and I think Americans have a pretty good understanding of how important that was. But a little bit of context to that, one of them is to recognize that at the time, the United States was the only functioning democracy in the world. There were, you know, military dictatorships and monarchies and parliamentary governments, a few others, but there were no functioning democracies. And so the whole world watched with great interest as America began to tear itself apart, because they knew that, you know, only one of two things could happen. Either the United States would take this idea of a people's government to the grave, or they would survive and, you know, continue to allow this foundation of democracy around the world as well. And the other thing is worth remembering is that up to that point, there was no reason to be optimistic that the Union was going to win that war. Mm-hmm. You know, Abraham Lincoln had disloyal generals. He had, you know, incompetent staff. There were riots throughout the North. Some of the northern states were threatening to leave the Union, join with the South, form their own union. It was a desperate, desperate time. You know, Abraham and his army had had a few victories, but not many, and by and large, nothing significant. Everything hung in the balance there at Gettysburg in that 3 days in July. And I think, again, Abraham Lincoln had this very, very emotional, very personal experience while he was praying for deliverance from this, you know, near catastrophe. And I think that's one of my favorites in that book, is that story.
One of your online videos on your campaign website, I believe, and please correct me if I'm describing this wrong, indicates that you believe this is, to some extent, divine intervention that we're talking about. Is that correct?
When we describe these miracles in U.S. history?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and like I say, we're kind of careful with that because the word miracle is, you know, it means different things to different people. But yeah, I believe, and I think, frankly, most Americans believe, and there's pretty significant body of evidence, polls and other sources, that most people agree with this idea that you know, most Americans believe in some type of God, and most Americans believe that God can intervene and that He is interested in the affairs of man. And, you know, we think that that's the case here, that he really was interested in helping to preserve this nation at critical times.
Do you have a, what are your views on faith and government then? And do you worry at all that people might think you're talking about intermingling politics and religion?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we've been very, very careful when we're campaigning, as we're campaigning for federal office. And I don't think religion has any part in the campaign and should have any part, other than it's clearly something that has shaped mine and yours and other people's generally, their background and their philosophies are many times, you know, a result of their religious upbringing or their, you know, philosophies that they've been taught by their parents or other things. So, I mean, it plays a part, I think, in all of our thinking. But we have never and would never want to indicate to people that it's appropriate to mingle, you know, religion and church and state. You know, there needs to be a dividing line there. We need to recognize that, you know, those of us we're selecting to lead us in a political or in a national office, you know, they're not our pastors. Mm-hmm. They're not our preachers. They're our political leaders, and to recognize them for what they are there and to separate those two.
This is Politics Up Close on KCPW. My guest is Chris Stewart. He is the Republican nominee for Utah's 2nd Congressional District. Still a few chances to join us on the air at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Well, Chris, to get into your political platform in more in depth, your campaign is based on what you refer to on your website as 7 critical measures, and let's hone in on a couple of those. One of the most talked about in this election and all elections is tax reform.
Yeah.
What is your specific proposal? I understand you have some basic ideas when it comes to the income tax brackets and how you think those should be structured.
Yeah. You know, I'll bet you share this frustration, and a lot of your listeners will, with the tax code. It's cumbersome. It's inefficient. It brings a lot of uncertainty into our lives. I mean, I don't know from 1 year. I can't anticipate how much in taxes I'm going to pay the next year. And it's a burden on our economy. And we've proposed, you know, simplifying it. And that's the key, simplifying it. You know, if you like the current tax system and you want to stay in that, we allow you the option of doing that. If you want to pay accountants and lawyers and continue with, you know, hundreds of page forms, you know, knock yourself out and do that. But for the rest of us, we want to provide the option of literally completing your taxes on a postcard, which is a phrase that you've heard before. But it's a very appealing idea for a lot of us. And that is, you know, very and to lower the tax brackets 10, 15, 25% and to eliminate. Now, this is one of the keys, eliminate all these loopholes and exemptions that people spend so much time and maneuver their decisions and choices trying to achieve, you know, reduce their tax liability. We propose only 2 exemptions, and they're for, you know, these 2 things. One of them for home ownership, because owning a home is part of the American dream, and the other is for charitable giving, because we believe that private charity does it much better than the government does. Other than those 2 things, it's very simple. How much did you make? What's your 10 or 15%? Do you have any of these 2 exemptions? And then here's your tax burden. I just think it would be a huge boon to our economy if we were to simplify and broaden our tax base.
Now, if you allowed people, though, the option of sticking with the current system if they so prefer, wouldn't that, you know, keep the problems of there being, for example, too many loopholes for certain write-offs for corporations and that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, you know, corporate taxes are a different deal, and we've proposed the same thing in the corporate side, and that's to reduce the tax rate. And my Democratic opponent agrees with us on that we should reduce corporate income taxes to stimulate the economy. I think, you know, your point is well taken, and we recognize that there will still be some. And in that case, then they and the IRS can have a great relationship, and we'll let the IRS take care of those folks. But for the rest of us, which is a vast majority, I mean, I would guess it would be well into the 90%. Most of us would be just really happy to have this much more simplified system.
Let's also talk about balancing the budget, Chris, and passing a balanced budget amendment. This is obviously something that's been discussed in Washington for well over a decade, and there have been attempts to pass it before. What do you think it will take in Congress to get enough votes, and it does require quite a significant amount of them, to get a balanced budget amendment?
You know, we were so close once. A lot of people forget that in the 90s we were within one vote. And I wonder sometimes how our economy and how our government would be different if we had been able to take that step, you know, 20 years ago or 15 years ago. And it's not easy to do, as you were saying. It's not like you pass this with a 51-vote majority. It's more difficult than that. But the reality is, and I got to tell you, I think that everyone gets this. And whether you're an independent, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, I really believe that everyone gets this. We can't keep spending the way that we are. We just can't. We just can't run $1.2, $1.4 trillion deficits every year. It's like someone making, $10 an hour and having nearly $160,000 on a credit card. That's what this means. And I see bipartisan concern for that. And if we don't have the courage to say, look, we need to address this. We can't keep doing this forever. And a balanced budget amendment, I think, is one of the first steps we can take in forcing Congress to have the courage to control this debt.
Listeners, join us on the air at 801-355-8255. Nathaniel is calling in from Logan. Hi, what's your question or comment for Chris Stewart?
Yes, I understand that when Chris was running for the Republican nominee, several of the Republican candidates didn't inside of the boundaries for the second district. So I just, and I understand that his opponent now, his Democratic opponent, doesn't live in the district. So my question is just what his opinion is of whether or not a representative should live among the people they claim to represent.
Interesting question, Nathaniel. I'm not sure about Democrat Jay Segmiller and which district he lives in, but this has been an issue before with Congressman Chaffetz, as you know, Chris. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, we have always said, and I think, again, the feedback we get from voters as we went out and talked to them, a vast majority agree with this. This second congressional district, we have enough leadership here. We can choose someone from among us to represent us. We made that argument against some of the Republican opponents. And, you know, our opponent, Democratic opponent now, he does not live in the district. I don't know whether there's as much interest in that now as we're talking about ideas, but I think that there is. And I think most people would say, again, we want our neighbors to represent us. I think that's the way it was designed, that the intention was that someone from within that district would represent that district.
Nathaniel, thank you for the call. 801-355-8255 is our number. Chris, let's talk about something that, you know, is relevant to your previous career, national defense.
Yeah.
As you put it on your website, you want to ensure our national defense. But you've said in the past that doesn't necessarily mean increasing military spending. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I think there's two elements to this. Number one is if I'm serious, and I am serious about trying to control our debt, and if I were to say to folks, you know, we've got to cut spending in every area except for national defense. As a former military officer, we just can't cut national defense. I think most people would look at me and say, you're not serious about this. Because as a member of the military, I can promise you this, as important as that is, and I understand the fundamental responsibility of the federal government is to protect us. But still, Department of Defense is a large bureaucracy, and there's elements there that we could, you know, there's inefficiencies and places that we could trim and that we could be more efficient there. And so I'm putting everything on the table. I'm saying we have to control our debt through some cuts in every government program. But, there is nothing the federal government does that's more important than protecting you and I. And having spent some time, looking and evaluating and understanding the threat that we face, I understand that we still live in a dangerous world and we have to be prepared. And I would never support cutting our defense to the point where it would endanger our security.
There's been a lot of discussion, particularly among libertarian groups, about closing military bases, for example. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think there indeed could be an evaluation of that?
Absolutely. I think the BRAC, we've gone through three BRACs, you know, base realignment and closures, through the 90s and then in the early part of the, 2000s. And one of our early supporters, Congressman Jim Hansen, who was, member of those BRAC base closing commissions, they save something close to $30 billion a year.
Wow.
Each BRAC has been identified as saving something like $10 billion, taken together between the three of them, $30 billion. And if you look at the number of bases we have overseas, there's hundreds of them. Now, if you're calling Camp Vicious in the mountains of, Afghanistan that have 12 or 15 Marines there, a military base, no, I'm not. Those aren't, those are outposts. But we do have significant military installations overseas that we could be more efficient and save a little bit of money if we were to consolidate or close some of those. Everyone knows that's true. I mean, I don't know anyone who would argue you can't make things more efficient with some of these closings because we're three for three. We've done it three times and have saved, as I said, billions of dollars by it. The question is, again, will Congress have the political will to go forward with that now?
Chris, let's go to the phones again. Bruce is calling from Ogden. Hi, Bruce. What's your question or comment for Chris Stewart?
Well, it's essentially two parts. His opponent, Jay Sekmeler, has a 3-2-1 economic plan, and I was curious what Chris's take was on that and what his plans are personally to strengthen the economy, to get this, things back to where those who want jobs can find a job, where parents can support their families.
All right. Thank you for the call, Bruce. We appreciate it. I believe Jay Sekmeler held a news conference this week making the point that he says your economic plan would lead the nation over a cliff.
Yeah.
I can't quite remember exactly the details of that press conference,
yeah.
But what are your thoughts on his plan, and what's your plan for job creation?
Well, you know what? I was a little surprised with Jay in that press conference how negative he was towards us. You know, he called us reckless and fatalistic and, you know, I think a lot of other superlatives. And here's the deal. At its essence, it's this. I think Jay has an economic plan that President Obama would support. I have an economic plan that's based largely off the Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney economic plan. And we could go into the details, and I can't address Jay's 3-2-1 plan. I think he's best able to do that. But I can draw that parallel. I think President Obama would completely support Jay's. It calls for more government intervention. It calls for more government spending, more stimulus spending, whereas we look to the free market. And it comes down to this basic thing. The most important issue right now, I think, when you look at our economy and other elements about that, are jobs. That's the thing people key on. You look at the unemployment rate, 8.3%. The real rate is something closer to 15%. That's the thing that people understand and want to have addressed. The government cannot create jobs. The private sector is the only entity that can create jobs. Now, the government can take money from someone and send it through the bureaucracy and waste some of it there and then give it to someone else. But that's not creating a job. You've taken money out of the private sector to do that. And again, I think that that's the essence of comparing our two plans. We want to reinvigorate the private economy. We want to reduce government regulation. We want to, you know, work towards energy independence and the jobs that that would create. We want to control government spending and take that damper, that break off of the economy. And I think that's kind of the heart of this argument, the principles that we'll be talking about here, is what is a proper role in job creation? Is it the private economy or is it government? And we've had 4 years to look at stimulus spending and other government interventions, the Keynesian economics, and people can draw their own conclusions, but it's hard for me to see how you could argue that it's been good at creating jobs.
Chris, we have just a few moments left, so let's get to one more part of your campaign platform, defederalizing public lands, which make up about, you know, roughly two-thirds of Utah, 66%. There's an effort on the legislative level to try and take control of these lands from the federal government to demand that the Interior Department hand them over. Do you think that's effective, or do you think this is something that needs to be accomplished there in Washington primarily before in Utah?
Yeah, again, Jeff, it's a great question. And if you go down to large parts of our district, this is a huge issue for those folks, and it should be. I mean, there's counties in this district that are 97% controlled by the federal government. Couple that are 90%. I love the Ken Ivory bill, if for no other reason, which is the one you were talking about working its way through the state legislature. If for no other reason, then it draws attention to this fact. And it indicates the frustration with those of us who are living in the state saying, you know, why can you go out east and there's virtually any or very, very little federal land, and yet you come out to the west and huge parts of the western states are controlled by the federal government. And many of us look at that and wonder why. Why is that? And how can we change that? But I agree with you, I think, towards the end of your question, and that is this. The answer, it can't be addressed in the state legislature. It has to be addressed in the federal Congress. And we look forward to going back there and fighting for that. And I think the door will be open for some changes in that just wasn't open before. I do think that the Congress is more inclined to consider some of our appeals there and asking that question, why do you control so much of our own state? Look, if you're in a county that's 97% controlled by the federal government, how do you have a tax base to fund your schools? How do you have a tax base to build roads, to do the things that help people's lives, to build libraries, to have public radio? How do you do that when you have no tax base? And those are the kind of appeals that I think people back east and in the Midwest will appreciate because that's something that, you know, all of us understand. You got to be able to have money to take care of the people who live in the county, and you can't do that if the government controls all of that land.
We've been speaking with Chris Stewart. He is the Republican nominee for Utah's 2nd Congressional District in this year's election. His opponent is Democratic candidate Jay Segmiller. And Chris, thank you very much for your time and for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
This is Politics Up Close. We'll be right back.